Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
Osiris. Welcome to Wheels Off, a show about the messy reality of the creative life. I'm Rhett Miller. That's when it got wheels off. We started up and we ain't gonna stop. Us, I like you, like it or not. That's when it got wheels off. John Ross Bowie is an actor, he's a screenwriter, he's a comedian, he's an improv artist. He is an author. He's a dad. He is a podcast host. He does a lot of stuff. And I'm sure the list goes on from there because he's a bit of an overachiever. He and I know each other because of Thrilling Adventure Hour, I think. We've crossed paths a lot over the years. We've done a lot of shows together. And it's always a blast. He is a genuine, fun guy. He's got a spark about him that I really love and appreciate. When I had the idea to do these conversations that became the podcast that is Wheels Off, it was about the kind of conversation that I've had with John over the years in backstages and green rooms and cafes. You know, it's this conversation about life. What are we doing? How do we do it? How do we do art? Why do we do art? This stuff is all so weird. Oh, it's so tricky. So to get to have that conversation with John for you guys was a real treat. And I learned things about him during the course of the conversation that I didn't know before. And I'm just so glad that you get to peek inside of his mind. And I think you're really going to appreciate the insights that you'll find there. So please welcome to Wheels Off the great John Ross Bowie. Welcome to Wheels Off, John Ross Bowie. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, Rhett, I'm so happy to be here.
From the edification, or for the edification of our listeners, from where are you joining us?
I am in my living room in Los Angeles. We have a recliner in the corner of the living room. There's like this little carve out, and we kind of jokingly call it the office. I'm in our office right now, which is just a laptop, microphone, family photo. Whoever like gets here first in the day has it for the rest of the day. And it's pretty close to the router, and it's some choice real estate here in this three bedroom. It's nice. It's not bad.
Have you ended up getting into more voiceover nowadays during the pandemic than you were doing before?
No, you know, it's funny. I get asked that question a fair amount. That is a very, very tough racket to break into, man. I have gotten some cartoon gigs, but they've all been because I was working for the network anyway. You know, when I was on an ABC show, I got a couple Disney opportunities that kind of fell into my lap, and you know, it was all just sort of like this, you know, best not to think too hard about it, corporate synergy. But there's a real gift to voiceover work, and I've got friends who do very well at it, and I have just not cracked that code. I hardly ever do like the commercial gigs, but those are going to enormous actors right now. Like Brian Cox is doing McDonald's. That's Brian Cox selling the Big Mac. And my wife and I were sitting there like, that's 100% the patriarch from Succession. That is absolutely the patriarch from Succession selling us this burger right now. So yeah, it's a, It is rarefied air in the voiceover world, and I have not cracked that code. It's a shame too, because I have this awesome new microphone that my podcast network gave me that is, you know, directional and strong, and I got a great XLR cable with it, and it's just sitting here, and it's great for the podcast, but that's all I am using it for.
I was pretty sure you were going to say I have this awesome voice, and I was going to agree with you. You really do.
I have a specific voice. I don't know how awesome it is. It is idiosyncratic, I think, is the word we're hunting for.
So what creative project are you working on at the moment, and how is it lighting you up?
The thing I'm lit up by the most right at this moment is this podcast I've been doing called Household Faces, where I interview character actors. I interview people who are instantly recognizable, but maybe don't have name recognition, and have what our British friends call jobbing actors. So they're not, you know, drowning in offers all the time. They go from job to job. They're often not entirely sure when their next job is coming, but they have been working for, you know, decades in some cases. And it's been really, really interesting during this. You know, I worked a little bit during the pandemic, and I just had a one-off sitcom gig last week. But, you know, I've obviously been going through, like a lot of people, a substantial employment lull. What with this global pandemic. I don't know if you follow the news, but there was a global pandemic, and it's been strange because it's. Acting is one of those things where you really can't do it in a vacuum. You know, I can't do like a stage it show necessarily. Not that like musicians have it easy by any stretch right now, but it's still a very weird time to work in a field that requires an audience. So in that lull, I have reached out to other actors who are going through similar purgatories. And it's been really fun to sort of talk to people. The common thread with all of these actors is that they don't really, they love it. They really love the work because they're not hugely rich and famous from it. So it's clearly just for the love of it. Which is neat. You know, there's the people who are like, well, I got to keep acting because, you know, I got to pay off that castle in Italy. You know, this is not who I'm talking to. I'm talking to the people who are just trying to pay off the house in Woodland Hills, you know, and it's exciting to see people who, for whom this is a real career. You know, it's not a golden handcuff situation. This is just what they love doing, and they're grateful for every opportunity they get. This is a very long-winded answer to your question. The answer is I'm doing a podcast, Rhett.
I love it. I feel like when people think about your job or my job, they think about the extremes, right? The castle dwellers or, you
the
know,
waiters.
The gutters, the waiters. Yeah, the gutter dwellers. But there's something about being middle class, like the middle class in the music industry got sort of cut out. And, you know, I feel like I'm one of the few working musicians that's not one of the extremes. But I feel like maybe in acting there, it does allow for a little more middle class. But I guess if you're looking at a percentage of the overall actors, it's still an incredibly small percentage that are able to make a living.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, if you go by actual union membership and the people who are working regularly within that union membership, it's pretty small. But yeah, pound for pound, given the vagaries of our respective businesses, I think it's easier to maintain a middle class. And again, we're using middle class in quotes. Please understand that there's a middle class to the arts that is different from what middle class looks like in Akron or what have you. But the I think it's easier to maintain a middle ground in acting. But you're right. There is a striking misunderstanding about what it means to not be hugely rich and famous, but also not have a day job. And it's that sort of interesting air that we're exploring with the podcast. I think it's also weird because that you get people who my most recognizable credit is Big Bang Theory, which, you know, ran for 12 years and I was on, you know, I did 25 episodes and it was lovely and I'm very, very grateful. But, you know, it's funny, people assume that I made a lot more than I did being on that show. You know, I'm certainly not complaining about how I was compensated for my work, but the reason the main stars of that show's salaries made headlines is because they were a total anomaly in this business. That's why it was newsworthy. Mine didn't make a headline, and there's a reason. but it is very interesting. Like, and again, this is me getting, you know, it was very easy to dismiss me as like, oh, he's just a bit player and he, you know, probably still has to temp. But now I'm sort of getting this other misconception that like I'm in some sort of gated community. And I've honestly only ever been to a gated community once and was super uncomfortable. But like I went to a party one time that was actually within a gated community, and people are always my social media can be a little bit of a shit show sometimes, and people are constantly like, why don't you move out of your gated community? I'm like, I'm renting the bottom of a duplex, man. I'm not complaining, but let's fucking have some perspective.
You do interact more than I think I could ever imagine. And I think it's, you're doing God's work. You're fighting the good fight, but does it take a lot out of you, John?
It is. Well, I left Twitter, which has helped immeasurably.
Yeah.
Leaving Twitter, because there is something about, you know what it is that on Twitter, you're just, you Twitter's like an arena and you go, I just bumped my mic. Let me start over. Twitter is like this arena and you go into the arena and everyone is just duking it out and everyone can see the arena. Instagram is like your lawn. And if someone comes onto your lawn and comments and puts something in there that is genuinely harmful, you can delete their post. You can delete their comment rather, you know, and you can't delete somebody else's comment on Twitter. So for that very simple reason, I have left Twitter and am focusing my stuff on Instagram, and I'm trying to keep things civil, but you know, the internet's going to internet and troll is going to troll. And it is probably the thing that annoys my wife the most about me is me engaging. There is a community I'm involved with that has a slogan, which is you don't have to show up to every fight you're invited to. And I need to put that like right at eye level on my laptop. And I will. I'm going to post that. I'm going to get a post-it and just put that right there. And because, you know, I don't, you know, nobody wants to go to their grave going, boy, I sure did show that troll what for, you know?
So I know you came to where you're at now a roundabout way. Like, you've done a lot of different stuff, and I admire that, and I feel like you continue to flex your muscles in different directions. I don't know if that metaphor works, but I wonder for you,
fascinating image though.
I know. I wonder for you, when you were starting out, did you know that you wanted to act specifically? Did you know you wanted to live a life in the arts? Generally, was there like an epiphany moment? How did it start for you?
That's a really good question. And the answer is yes, but I kept it to myself. I, as a very young child, wanted to be an actor. I was watching TV and was like, oh, that looks amazing. Can we go visit Rhoda? And my parents were like, Rhoda's not real. That's like, but she lives in New York. Like, well, okay, the character lives in New York. The actress lives in a, you know, lives in LA, and that's a soundstage, probably in a place called Burbank. And I was fascinated by that. So I announced that I wanted to be an actor. And I did like plays in elementary school, like very early on in elementary school. And then I started to see, I grew up in Manhattan. I grew up in the West 40s of Manhattan, which is the theater district. And I saw a lot of my friends' parents try to make it as actors and really struggle. And there was just a lot of uncertainty and there was a lot of literal tears. And then somewhere around 12, I developed this very profound fear of public speaking. I just felt like people had suddenly, like, I was kind of a late bloomer, and suddenly there were all these guys whose voices had changed and were tall all of a sudden starting in seventh grade. So those two things, like this very practical concern about, like, I don't think these people make a living, versus meeting with this sudden realization that I was not cool and I was short and my voice was cracking all the time, just sort of combined to make acting this very elusive goal. So I had a very circuitous route to it. So in the 15 or so years that I took off from the dream, I kind of did a bunch of other things. Like I worked in college radio, and thought about doing that professionally, which was nice because that got me over the public speaking hump, because I could talk to people I couldn't see. And like the next morning they would say, "Hey, I liked your set last night. I liked your shift on the air. I had never heard that REM deep cut." This is the early 90s. And thank you for playing that music. And so that was sort of a, oh, okay. So this was just sort of a delayed, like, I can speak to these people. They can hear me. I'm not looking at them. And then I was an English major. One is never really entirely sure what they're going to do with an English major. So I opted, having kind of gotten over the public speaking hump, I opted to study to be a high school teacher. Went back to my old high school, taught for 1 year. That almost broke me. I was like 20. I mean, I was 22. You know, I had topped off at 5'8". You know, I was, you know, I shaved every day, but I didn't have to. You know, it's like one of those things where I just looked like a senior in a tie, and it was very hard to command respect. You know, it was just really, really hard to command respect. And as frustrating as it was, there was a huge part of me that just could not blame the students for looking at me and being like, "Yeah, I'm going to get up and leave, and you're not going to stop me." So that happened. And then that felt like I had just sort of rushed myself into adulthood. So then I started a band, and I was in a punk band for about 3 or 4 years. And then that broke up, and I got profoundly depressed. I had nothing creative going on in my life at all. I was trying to be a writer. That wasn't really working out. I was just really, really, and I'm not tossing the word depression around freely. You and I have talked about this. I think it was a really like deep existential funk of like, what am I doing? I am working in an office as my day job. I am writing marketing copy for a consulting firm. I'm like writing brochures for these people. I don't think I'm that good at it. I don't believe in what the company is doing. I just had this very awful quarter life crisis, and a friend suggested I take improv classes, and I was really scared of improv. But it's one of those things where, you know, you get to a place where you kind of get into a headspace where you have nothing to lose, and you might as well do something that terrifies you, because you're sitting in a cubicle drenched in panic all the time anyway. So given that panic is now the baseline, you might as well just go ahead and do something scary. So I started taking improv classes, and yeah, the moment you asked about came in that first class. I went up there, I got a laugh. It felt good. I got another laugh, felt really good. I sat down, and this woman who I'm going to name check, named Celia Bresak, looked over her shoulder and said, that was a good scene. So are you an actor? And I said, no. And, you know, when, you know, they're not going to make a cheesy biography movie of me, but should they, that would be a moment where the camera pushes in and there's some sort of nice orchestral cue to, you know, tip us off how the rest of the thing's going to go.
I love that. I love that. You're reminding me the other day when the kids and I were at a restaurant near an airport coming home from a family vacation, they were asking about acting and actors and friends of mine that act and what it's like. And I said, well, you know, my favorite actors and some of my, my best friends that act really started in improv. So they were asking me a lot about improv, about which I know very little, just from, a bunch of, the Thrilling Adventure folks and different friends of mine. And we started at the table at this restaurant doing improv, the kids and there are three of us. So I'd say to the one who wasn't going to be doing it, okay, name an occupation and a location. And then the others, we would just start doing it. And it was one of the most fun lunches I've ever had in my life.
We do that with the kids. We do improv games with the kids sometimes, which is incredibly satisfying and incredibly fun. And it kind of gives them this tailwind. It just gives them like, my God, look at what I'm capable of.
Yeah.
Look at what is sitting lying dormant inside me. It was a real game changer for me. It was a real, and it makes you, if you do it properly, it makes you even more adept with scripted material, because you're already used to listening. You're already used to paying extra attention. So even when you know what the person is going to say to you, because it's all scripted, you're still hopefully able to lock in and notice the different ways they say it in each take and sort of dimensionalize each version of the scene you end up doing. It's an invaluable tool.
So you've alluded to some internal struggles. And I wonder, what have you figured out over the years? come on. No, I mean, I think you're doing pretty great. Like you're living an examined life, right? Which is the life worth living.
Right. Okay. Fair enough.
But I wonder, like, what tricks have you figured out? What have you pushed through those internally generated obstacles?
I don't mean to be flippant. Yes, I obviously have. I'm here to tell the tale. I'm at a not advanced age, but I recently hit a milestone, and I've got two pretty healthy kids that I support. One of the big things I've learned, and this can't be said enough, is that depression is temporary. Like, you can only go through a really gnarly depression for the first time once. And that first time you go through a really gnarly depression, it's terrifying and awful. And it feels like the world is giving way underneath you. But you will likely get through it. And once you get through it, when it returns, you are able to go, okay, I've been here before. It's not fun, but it will pass. And that's something I really wish someone had told me when I first had my breakdown, which I'm pretty comfortable calling a breakdown. I think if you sob in your cubicle at work, we call that a breakdown, right? I don't think we're overusing the term. I think that's a legitimate breakdown. Well, I really wish someone had told me that this was temporary. You're not always going to feel like this. The other thing that has helped, particularly during these past 16 months of awful, has been just a real focus on the connection between mind and body and just exercising. I know it sounds so kind of tropey and LA, but you just gotta get out there and move your body. And it's really hard. And it's, if you wake up in a shitty mood, like the last thing you want to do is get up and move your body, but it can feel like you are lifting sandbags up a ladder sometimes, just going out for a walk. But if you can get that one sandbag up, the others will be easier, and it will build from there. What else? I quit drinking about 10 years ago. That was really good for me. I was not a crazy rock bottom alcoholic by any stretch, but I was definitely drinking more than I thought was appropriate for a father of two. When I stopped, I had to start looking at like the anxiety and fear that was making me drink in the first place. And so I'm able to work on that too. So, there's just a bunch of things. What's really helped, actually? What's really helping lately? And I say this to you because you're looking at me from in front of a wall of guitars. So I'm reading this book, right? Hear me out. I'm about to get so fucking LA on you. I'm reading I'm reading the new Oprah book. Stay with me, Rhett. And she wrote it with a doctor named Dr. Bruce Perry, I want to say. And the title is What Happened to You? Hang on, please stay with me. And it's about dealing with childhood trauma. And we're using trauma as a very large umbrella. There's obviously the kind of trauma that Oprah went through, which was sexual assault and horrible things like that. But there's also stuff like, you know, like having a drunk dad or getting mugged when you were very, very young because you were living in, you know, New York in the 70s and 80s, you know, all the sort of lowercase t traumas that come your way. And one of the things that keeps coming up and that we are losing as a culture is the idea of singing together in rhythm and the curative powers of music. So I've been just playing a lot more guitar over the pandemic, and I've been writing songs again, and it's yes. been and I don't even think they're necessarily for public consumption, but they have been so curative, and not everyone has that opportunity, and there's people who are genuinely tone deaf, but I bet there's more people who can do it than realize they can. And not to give away a trade secret, not to encroach upon your gifts, but you know, find your songwriting, find your noodling around on acoustic guitar. I printed out these charts that basically are just blues tablature charts, so I can like put a backing riff in A on my phone and then sit down and noodle over that for 10 minutes, and I feel like $1 million afterwards.
Wow.
I get up and I'm just, I, you know, and I sound like, you know, 2-year-old buddy guy. I sound terrible, but I'm not hitting wrong notes too often, and I'm just really enjoying myself doing it. And music has been incredibly palliative in the past year and a half.
God, I love that. That's something I truly believe, you know.
You found that? I mean, in your operating as you have, you know, and you've got a solo career, yes, but you're used to being in a band, and there's nothing like being in a band. And that is a kinship that is hard to explain to others, but the shows you've been doing must be just such a godsend right now.
Yeah. And it's way beyond, you know, just, the being able to replace lost income, but you know, it's like, it's a purpose, you know, it's a tendril that reaches, you know, through bounces off a satellite and hits another person, and then we're connected. It's beautiful. It helps a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love that you've been, that you take requests and you're surprising covers. I didn't see the show, but I went on to, I go on to Setlist FM sometimes just to check up on, see what people are doing. And, you did a Cramps cover the other night.
That's from high school. I've been covering TV sets since I was in high school.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's so great. Well, I love that. Like, yeah, I'm a Cramps fan. I love the Cramps. And,
oh, yeah.
And they were, I saw them on the Date with Elvis tour, and they are, I'm just getting a little more rootsy in my tastes too, as I get older. Like, I'm absolutely, you know, you've listened to me playing, you know, trying to play blues guitar and listening to more like folk and country and stuff. So I love the fact that you're bringing the Cramps into your oeuvre. I mean, I guess it's not a huge gulf between the two of you, but it's still a really fun thing that you're doing. That's awesome.
It's funny, the old 97s in our earliest days were, we played multiple Cramps songs in our sets when we didn't have enough originals.
Oh, really?
In fact, the gold tooth I have in my lower teeth is because we were doing some new kind of kick. And during an encore, and I was drunk, and I stuck the microphone in my mouth, of course, because when you're doing
Lux Interior.
Yeah. And when I pulled it out, the tooth came with it, blood and the tooth on the floor. And it was pretty great.
That's glorious.
That's great.
That's quite the war wound.
Okay. So in a moment, I'm going to ask you to sort of distill all of this wisdom you've been sharing. But before then, we're going to have to take a quick break and hear from our sponsors. And we're back. John Ross Bowie, I'm so glad to have you here in Wheels Off with me. And I feel like I could talk to you all day, but we try to keep these to like a half an hour so we don't wear out our welcome. I say we because there's an entire team of people that help put this together. And as a podcaster, you now know this, right?
I do now know this. And I also try to keep my stuff. I can't do a half hour, but I can do an hour. And I do try to keep it to about an hour.
Yeah.
And I just feel like, you know, like you've got like a steady 50 mile ride, you know, that someone's using you for, you know, and just honor that.
Yeah.
It shouldn't take more than like two trips to cover your podcast. You know, you just get in there. But I brevity is the soul of wit, Rhett. I love this.
If you were to, and this boy, when I talk to people who have kids, especially teenagers or kids getting close to those ages, it's it becomes like a something that you're dealing with in real life every day. But if you were to run across a 21-year-old, say, version of yourself working in today's world, living in today's world, what advice might you give yourself?
A 21-year-old version of myself living in today's world. Okay. Yeah. Okay. It's funny. I talk about this all the time with my friends, my other middle-aged friends. The thing I would advise a 20-year-old version of me to do if they were living in 2021 is stay the fuck off social media because you have a big mouth and you drink. So shush, shusha, shush, stay off of that. Not everyone needs to know your thoughts. That would be the primary thing. And I think if you nip that in the bud, a lot of your other problems can go away. But, you know, it's funny. Like I don't look back at, you know, I have friends who ask if they are worried, if I'm ever concerned that I started to a little later, you know, because I was 28 when I started booking commercials, which is, you know, by no means old, but it's a little bit of a late start for acting. You know, there's a lot of people who start when they're teenagers. There's a lot of people who start right after they get their BFA or whatever at 22. And there's people like, do you ever wish you got a kind of an earlier start? And I have blown it. I'd have absolutely blown it. I know it. If I'd started earlier, I needed to spend a year teaching high school. I definitely needed to spend a few years in a band. I don't have, you know, could I have been kinder to some people along the way? Yeah, absolutely. I regret that. But in terms of the decisions I made within my own life, you know, the 21-year-old John, should steer clear of the booze, but for the most part, keep on keeping on, man. It's going to work out. I feel like people get, I don't know. You're right. You're asking me to distill something that's very hard to distill. It's like a big chunky stew, and you're trying to make it boil it down to its essence. And I'm having trouble doing that. And it's a worthwhile question, right? Don't get me wrong, but I just feel like I could have spent a lot less time worrying and a lot less time being scared of the future. And I still could, no question. But especially in my early 20s, it has all worked out the way it was supposed to. And I'm really grateful for that.
It's funny how often that, I mean, I guess I'm 70 episodes into doing these conversations, recording them at least. I had them pre-podcast for years. It's funny how often what it comes down to is just wanting to like love that kid, right? And say,
yeah,
it's going to be okay. Like when we're young, it seems everything seems so important and so terrifying.
Yeah, it really is. But I would love to just tell the 21-year-old that he's going to keep his hair. And he's because that was up in the air for a little while. I had a bald grandfather on my mom's side. And I was like, I don't know, man. I don't know. I don't. And I have a weird bumpy skull. I don't think it'd be a good look on me. I don't have that like Vin Diesel, like smooth thing going on. It would have been. But, you know, you're going to keep your hair. You're going to find love. You're going to have beautiful, healthy kids, and you're going to have the sort of career that you yourself liked watching when you were a kid. You know, you're not going to be hugely famous, but you'll be recognizable and you'll be known for doing, you know, you'll be known as a reliable workhorse of an actor. And you'll be surprised how much awesome stuff is coming your way. And yeah, then you'd get a hug.
Oh, I love that. John, thank you so much for being on Wheels Off and letting us peek inside that funny, interesting, hilarious, complicated brain of yours.
Oh, that's very generous of you, Rhett. Thank you. I love the show. Thank you very much for having me on.
Dude, thanks so much. And I can't wait to listen to your podcast. It's going to be, I wish I was a working character actor. I could be on it.
I think you'd dig it though. It's honestly, I know you'll dig it because you are enough of a fan, I think, to appreciate the stuff that gets talked about on it. I think you'll enjoy it.
All right. Take care, John Bowie. Thank you so much.
Mwah.
All right. Thank you so much for listening to Wheels Off. Please be sure to rate and review the show on iTunes. That helps us appear higher in the search results and lets other folks know that it's a cool podcast to listen to. Also, as the kids say, don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or anywhere else that you listen to shows like this so that you never miss an episode. This has been Wheels Off, and I'm Rhett Miller, encouraging you to create every day. Thanks, y'all.
Osiris.
This is Krista Makes, guitarist and vocalist for Less Than Jake, and host of Krista Makes a Podcast, a songwriting podcast where every week I'm joined by an amazing guest to break down the writing, recording, and release of one iconic song from their career. In our giant, evergreen back catalog of episodes, we've had rock legends such as Dee Snider and Huey Lewis, punk rock favorites like Mark Hoppus, Fat Mike, and Brett Gurewitz, and up-and-coming artists of today such as Liz Stokes of the Beths and Genesis Owusu. We've had guests from all genres and styles of music, and I guarantee that if you peruse our back catalog, you'll see several episodes that'll make you say, "Man, I gotta hear that." Whether you're a fan of music or a creator of music yourself, you'll take away a whole new appreciation for the songs you know and love. Krista Makes a Podcast is available for free on all the places you could possibly listen to podcasts, and new episodes come out every Monday.